you're starting off, right? Okay. So I've got your last name. Okay.
Hi there.
So,
you know, right?
The down arrow?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, 30-second warning. Take your seats, please.
Yes.
Just a tiny bit of agenda prep. At the end of this panel, we're going to transition to our keynote, and there's not a break between this panel and that, so I'm going to ask you to, after the panel, not all get up and leave, because we're going to go right to our keynote before lunch. So please stick around so we can keep that agenda flowing. So the next panel, current state of crude by rail. We're very fortunate today to have Governor Kitzhaber's policy advisor for sustainable communities and transportation with us today, Carmen Pfor. We're not reading bios, but I have to say that Carmen really is absolutely a dedicated public servant and really serves not only the governor but the state of Oregon very well. And you can see her history with the state of Oregon by looking at her bio. So we're very pleased to have that. I'm sure Carmen will mention this, but she has to run off and help the governor with a meeting that's happening right down the road here. So she's going to make some remarks and then hand the podium over to her able replacement. So with that, Carmen, it's all yours.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Very kind words. Good morning, and it's a great pleasure for me to be here. And just so you know, I'm handing it off to is Travis Brower. He's the assistant director at the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I know many of you here are from parts well beyond Oregon, so the remarks that I'm going to give to you today are beyond the state of Oregon. And really, it's looking at the issue of crude oil by rail and how is it that we arrived where we're at today. Well, as many of you know, last year in July, there was an accident in Lac-Mégantic, Canada, where a train, from that was in another town called Nance, not properly set. The brakes in the train were not properly set. The train itself was on a 1.2% slope, and once the train was released, it gradually rolled down the hill and crashed into Lac-Mégantic and ultimately killed 47 people. They had to evacuate about 2,000 people from the community, and there were ongoing issues related to the rail operator, Canada, pulling their ability to operate, and then ultimately how much liability coverage did they have in hand in order to be able to mitigate for the consequences of that accident. Here in the United States, subsequently we've had, and there were more than this, but there are three major rail incidences that caught the attention primarily of elected officials and people across the country. The first was in Aliceville, Alabama. It occurred in November of last year. In this instance, it was a Genesee and Wyoming train traveling below speed on tracks that had been inspected a few days before. There were no lives lost in this accident. In fact, none of the three incidences I'm going to, from the United States, that's the case. But ultimately, this accident's under investigation. They're not exactly certain what happened here at this time. In Castleton, North Dakota, the accident that probably captured the most attention, this is an accident that kind of sounds like a bad math problem. A westbound train had derailed, and the eastbound train carrying the crude oil ran into this train, and several of the cars were engulfed in flame. Again, they evacuated evacuated the nearby town, but no lives were lost. And then finally, in Lynchburg, Virginia, in April of this year, there was a derailment of a CSX train carrying Bakken crude. The part with this particular accident that caught attention was that many of the cars were the higher standard car, and yet still with those cars, some of them were punctured. There had been a previous hearing at the National Transportation Safety Board, and the issue was what standard of tank car should we use to carry this particular cargo. So why are we seeing more crude oil by rail today? Well, as many of you know, North America is experiencing a significant crude oil boom, and that boom is happening in two particular places. One's in the Canadian oil sands region, and the other is the recent expansion of shale oil production from the Bakken fields, located primarily in North Dakota, Montana, and the Eagleton, Ford, and Permian basins in Texas. Because of this increased growth in oil capacity in North America, we are now supplying about 66% of our crude oil demand. And this is just beginning to displace crude oil from our traditional sources located in Africa, the Middle East, and in Latin America. So ultimately, this crude needs to get delivered to refineries within the United States. And primarily, refineries have received crude oil through our pipeline system here in the United States and also through the barge network in the United States. Most of our refinery capacity is located in the Gulf Coast, about 43 refineries. But we do have refineries in the United States here on the West Coast located in the states of Washington and California. Oregon is not a state that has any refineries within our borders. So what led to the dramatic change, or when were we all aware of it, actually occurred slightly after the Lac-Mégantic accident. The Association of American Railroads at the end of last year released a report that detailed the growth in crude oil movement by train. In 2006, they denoted that approximately 3,000 shipments of crude oil were sent by train, but by 2013, that increased to 400,000 shipments. And the Congressional Research Service estimates that by the close of this year, we'll see 650 oil shipments being moved by train. So why train? Why rail? Well, for those who are the producers, our rail network provides a lot of flexibility. It is much more geographically extensive than our oil pipeline. We have about 57,000 miles in our crude oil network, and sorry for the quality of this graph, but I think you're familiar with the geography and you can see the darting lines. So that is, for the most part, our crude oil pipeline system. But we do have 140,000 miles of a rail network. This rail network is better able to get crude oil from production areas in North America to those coastal refineries located primarily, again, in the coastal regions of the Gulf and also here on the West Coast of the United States. For those who are the producers of crude, oftentimes you hear that they're moving crude oil by unit train. Not always, but there's a significant movement of crude oil by unit train. And so what does it provide them, or what is a unit train? Well, unit trains are those trains that really carry one type of car with one type of cargo, goes from one destination to another destination, and then back again. One of the advantages they have with unit trains is that they don't need to be switched or shunted in rail yards, so this saves time and reduces costs, and they can return to their point of origin once they are unloaded. And a train consists of about 70 trains to 120 tank cars, can carry about 50,000 to 90,000 barrels of oil. You all who do the marine side would be more familiar with how much the oil tankers. I think, if my memory was around 250,000 barrels to 400,000, depending on the size of those tank barges. So they are able to move significantly more quantities of oil, but what we can move by rail is not insignificant. And there are some safety benefits that operators will talk about. One is that they avoid decoupling and coupling in rail yards, which involves high-impact forces and introduces the opportunity for human error in the process. But there are some safety risks. Unit trains do concentrate a large amount of crude oil that is potentially harmful to the environment. And as you are all likely aware, last January, PHMSA had issued a safety alert saying that Bakken crude may be more flammable than traditional heavy crude. Subsequently, in July of this year, they did release a report saying that it is quantified appropriately, but they still feel that it is likely more flammable than other traditional heavy crudes. And ultimately, from their vantage point, given the flammability of Bakken and crude, and from many policymakers and communities, you know, concentrating that much oil in one location increases the probability that should an accident occur, large fires and explosions could result. But when we're looking at the quantity and overall movement of crude oil, it still remains not the most significant way that crude oil is moving and getting to refineries. What you're seeing here is a graph, and if you can't read all the amounts, it goes from 2008 to 2012, and it shows how crude oil was moved through the United States. The kind of light gray line is oil tankers, and the yellowish-orange line is by pipeline. And the other incorporates movement of crude oil by truck, by rail, and by barge. And what you can see all the way over into the next graph, which shows the same number of years, within that other line, the smallest percentage of crude oil is being moved by rail. But there's a significant point here that's important for policymakers and those involved in rail safety. It's not that simply a small amount of oil in the sum total is being moved by train that is of importance here. What is of importance is, do we have the safety mechanisms in place, and have we shored up the operating practices necessary to ensure that when we're moving crude oil by rail, it's as safe as possible? And that's really the question where we're at today. I think what you can clearly see demonstrated as well is, on the side as it relates to rail, it's not been the traditional practice to move this much quantity of crude oil over its history. But the one thing rail operators will say to you is that crude oil moving by train, we experience the smallest amount of spills when it's being moved by rail. Now, I would say, you know, you could argue as well that it's also the smallest amount being moved. But when we're looking at each particular mode, be it pipeline, tank vessels, barges, or tanker truck, we do see spillage on those issues, and as all the work that all of you are doing, it's how do we minimize and hopefully get to zero the amount of oil that is spilled in its particular movement. One of the things that's important, and is a bit separate in the rail industry related to the crude oil movement itself, is that in the last 10 years, there's been a bit of a renaissance in the rail industry, and what I mean by that is their investments into the rail lines. And this is a real important part of rail safety. What we do know is that when they're making significant investments to improve the trackage, we see a subsequent decrease in derailments of trains. And so this is the national look across the system. What I can tell for you in Oregon is this particular chart is exactly the same. And I'm certain you can see that when you look at states across the country. So overall, and for regardless of what's being hauled by rail, we want to ensure we're doing everything we can to improve the trackage and do all those safety measures, because we don't want trains derailing. But if we're adding hazardous materials onto the mix, it really speaks to the need to ensure that we're doing all we can to shore up our rail infrastructure. So for those of you who don't know, there are some key federal agencies responsible for the oversight and management of the transport of crude oil by rail. One is FRA. FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, regulates the safety of the trackage, rail equipment, grade crossings, operating practices, and the movements of hazardous materials on trains themselves. One of the things the FRA recently did in the light of all of this is that they started shifting their inspection practices to look at pockets of risks on the rail lines to make sure that we're using statistical data and doing what we can to both inspect and then work with the railroads to replace and improve the trackage where there are problems. The National Transportation Safety Board in the United States, their role is to investigate rail incidences and make recommendations toward preventing future incidences based on its finding. But unlike the FRA, they are not required to weigh the costs against the benefits when considering additional safety measures. Moreover, they don't have any regulatory authority. And PHMSA, which I mentioned earlier, it's a bit of a mouthful, Pipelines and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. What they do is they issue requirements for the safe transport of hazardous materials in the United States by all modes. And in this case, as it relates to the FRA, how do they enforce and go forward to mandate with the railroad companies how they move hazardous materials? Now, a piece of the work where you all likely do quite a little bit is related to the National Contingency Plan. How is it? What are those plans we have in place to shore up the safety of movements of hazardous materials? Well, within the United States, the National Contingency Plan is codified under federal regulation. It's binding and it's enforceable. Most other federal emergency response plans are administrative and don't quite have the codification of law. So as it relates to the following spills, the National Contingency Plan speaks to spills from vessels, pipelines, and on and offshore facilities, which includes motor vehicles and rolling stock. Now, the one place where the federal law is explicit is if an oil discharge impacts navigable waterways within the United States. Railroads themselves on the land side are required to have their own safety plans, and they're required by FRA to have what's either called a comprehensive plan or a basic plan. And these plans are designated based on the volume capacity of an individual rail car transporting oil. Now, comprehensive plans must ensure by contract or other means that the personnel and equipment are able to handle the worst-case discharge on their line. And they have a regulatory threshold of speaking to tank cars holding more than 1,000 barrels of oil. But the piece here, and you'll probably hear a lot of member of Congress honing in on this, is that the tank car that is of most concern, the DOT 111, holds only around 700 barrels of oil. These particular plans, so you know, are subject to FRA approval. Basic plans are needed for the smaller tank cars, and they're not subject to FRA approval. So when we're looking at all the issues related to oil trains and safety, there are a series of issues of focus. And the primary one you hear a lot about is the tank car design. And the tank car that has been most, that is the most worry for those in the business is the DOT 111. That was the one involved in the Lac-Mégantic accident. And NTSB is having on its most wanted list since 1991. They don't want it hauling ethanol or other types of volatile materials. The industry itself, the Association of American Railroads, and I can't remember the year off the top of my head, but they've already imposed a higher standard tank car and have been wanting to push to get to a higher standard of tank car. But they say it would require replacing 92,000 tank cars across the system within the United States. Now, I'll allude to this later, but yesterday the U.S. Department of Transportation just closed a comment on a rule. They're looking at a comprehensive rule related to rail safety, and one of the issues they're looking at is, well, what is the new tank car standard we should use to haul crude oil? They're anticipating that they'll come out with a final rule, I think, early next year. Does that ring true to you? Okay. Another issue that we're looking at is, again, preventing derailments. Now, broken rails and track welds are the leading cause of derailments in the United States. Derailments themselves were caused, these broken welds, and derailments between 2001 and 2010 caused about 670 derailments, and shack geometry defects were the second leading cause of the derailments. Another leading issue is railroad operations, and so the human elements. How are we dealing with terminal operations, railroad crew size, positive train control? This is a long, Congress has wanted this, but it's very expensive, and there are a whole host of implementation issues to eliminate human error in the operation of trains, both on the freight and the passenger side. And then route selection. This is more significant on the East Coast. We have a more robust rail network than we do here on the West, but one of the things the FRA is looking at in partnering with railroads is, can you find better places to run these particular trains? And then again, the incident and spill response plans. One thing that's been significantly important for emergency responders is when there's an accident, what's on that train when I arrive at the scene, and how do I get that information? Moreover, how do I find out or know what hazardous materials are running through our community? And this has been an issue in past incidences here in the United States. So accuracy of train cargo information is important. And that's extremely important as well, so they know the frequency, if there's going to be an increased frequency of crude oil or other hazardous materials flowing through their communities. And the things that they therefore need to work on in having that information, do they have the right personnel, who have the right training in place, the right equipment, and what is the appropriate community notification in order to do the work? There's also, this raises the issues of the rail versus pipeline development. I think for most of us here in this room, it's above our pay grade. It's really an issue for Congress and the administration, the State Department as well, but it certainly has been sprung up here on the West Coast. And then looking how products are packaged and quantified. Again, this gets back to the issue of, is Bakken crude more flammable? Should it be treated differently than other crude, or should it be treated the same? And if we treat it the same, how do we do the notifications? How should the cars, what kind of cars should we use? What sort of standards should we have? And then finally, state and local statutes and rules. Are budgets adequate? Do we have the right statutes in place? How will we all respond to the final comprehensive rule once it's in place? Ultimately, for someone like me working for a governor, I want to make sure that tribal communities, those volunteer firefighters to large city paid firefighters and people who do hazmat, people in hospitals, that we have the right equipment in place. We know what the private sector has in place, and we make sure that people have the right training. Quickly, USDOT started their kickoff by doing a call to action with the rail operators, and a lot of what happened in that call to action led to the comprehensive rule. First, they started with CEOs to begin to do safety improvements immediately. Then in May of this year, the secretary released an emergency order related to DOT 111 tank cars, saying railroad operators should try not to haul Bakken crude on DOT 111 tank cars. And then in July of this year, issued the comprehensive rule, which was built off all of these particular items you see on this list. Oregon is all, so we don't need to go into any of this because this really is the sum total of my presentation. But basically for Oregon, what we've again been looking at are resources. What do we have in place? Do we have the right plans? Do we have the right training? And how do we need to move forward in our state to ensure that if crude oil is going to be moved on rail and it's going to be passing through our state, we've done everything we can to protect special places and communities along those rail lines. So with that, I say thank you. And I have to apologize that I'm speaking quickly and darting off to something else. But I really am very honored to be here and enjoy the rest of your conference.
Thanks, Carmen. Carmen has to run off to a very important event, and as a result, I am going to be pinch hitting for her today. I'm Travis Brower, the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, which has responsibility around rail prevention issues. I'm going to give you a brief overview, and then we're going to turn it over to Dale, who's going to give a presentation about this issue. Since I am pinch hitting, I'm only really hoping for a solid single here as moderator. I'm going to try to moderate this very lightly, but we do have a great panel today. We're going to talk to you a lot about how crude rail has affected these organizations and what these organizations are doing to address issues of rail and transportation. We have three different states here that are represented, Washington, California, and Minnesota, as well as the federal government. So I think we're going to get a great perspective on all this. Dale's going to talk to us for about 10 minutes, and then what I'll do is come up and introduce each member of the panel and not give you the biography, but just give you the basic information about each person and then let them talk for a few minutes. Hopefully we'll have some time at the end for some questions. I have a few teed up, but if there is time, we'll also allow for members of the audience to ask questions. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dale Jensen from the Washington Department of Ecology.
Liz Bolton, can you come up to the podium, please? Thanks. Sorry, our computer went to sleep, and there's only one person who can wake it up.
Well, actually, while Sarah's bringing it up, I'll just go ahead and start talking. Basically, what we're going to do is we're going to show it's a situational awareness map that we put together. But one of the things I really wanted to talk about, I'd mentioned earlier, how excited I get about the work that the task force does. I mean, it really is amazing work. And one of the projects that we took on this past year, because of all the challenges, all the changes that we are seeing in our respective states, was to put together this map. And it basically goes from Alaska all the way down to the southern end of California. And so it's really focused on crude, but I think that, one of the things that we looked at is our governors are so interested, as Carmen said, about public health and safety, environmental protection. That's really foremost the big thing with all these changes that are going on. I think the other thing is a friend from the audience that I hadn't seen for a while said, Dale, it's good to see that the task force isn't focused on the marine side, anymore. Well, that's really a tough issue. issue for us as we're looking at the scope creep of the work that we're doing in the task force, because it's just a lot of work. And our coordinating committee members, which I have a new one, Kathy Taylor over here, is my new coordinating committee member. And my attorney, Leslie Suffern, is here today, too, to listen in and make sure that we're doing good work forward. So appreciate that. But I think it really is amazing the different things that we're all facing here. And that's really what this panel is about today and throughout the day today. We were just seeing so much as rail is coming into the marine side. There really is that interface on the facility point that really is affecting lots of changes on the marine side. So it really isn't just about marine anymore. You know, our work really is about this whole system that was talked about, you know, in other by other presenters today. There's this ever-evolving, changing, emerging picture that's going on. We want to make sure that we're situationally aware. And I think, you know, we were talking yesterday afternoon at the executive committee. I think one of the cool things about this task force work, too, is that we all have different pieces of information. We're working with all the companies. We're hearing all the concerns from our First Nations and our public. We have a pretty good picture that we can put together. And we hope that by doing this kind of work, having this out here, it's posted to our webpage. By having this, it really helps all of us, you know, look at this ever-emerging, changing, you know, picture. This is crude only, you know, right now. We did, you know, look at including refined products, and it just was really complicated. But we've got, you know, downturn in Alaska North Slope crude coming to Washington and California, where we're not as dependent, you know, on that as we were before. So that affects, you know, our funding, not only coming into Washington, but there have been some changes that have been done in California because of that. So there's this whole downturn in our dependence on crude coming in by ship, and it's really being replaced, you know, by the rail traffic, you know, coming in. We have an increase in barge traffic moving crude along the coastline. We have, as changes could occur, like the conversations that are going on around moving the export tax, you know, limit, that opens up, you know, new opportunities. If the Bakken oil has a condensate added, it allows it to be directly exported. We're looking at, you know, proposed methanol facilities. We're looking at, you know, conversations around or collecting the benzene off of the Bakken crude and shipping it to the West Coast and exporting it. So there's just LNG is another thing, not only for fuel, but also for consumption, moving that product, you know, in and out of some of our states. So there's just a whole lot of complexities that are going on that are facing all of us in this room and all of us in our state. So take a look at this map. It's a great product, I think. It's very helpful for us from a situational awareness standpoint. Our public, you know, expects us to be informing them in the best possible way. They have high expectations of all of us in this room, and we need to be shoulder to shoulder on a bad day, as we have been on the marine side. We need to make sure that we're doing that on the inland side, too. So with that, I'll turn it back to you. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Dale. You know, coming from ODOT, where we, like many agencies across the country, have really faced this rapid growth in the movement of crude by rail, we've certainly had to step up in recent years and look at what needs to be done to make sure the public is fully prepared, that emergency responders have the resources they need in order to address the issues raised by crude by rail. Carmen, who had to scoot away, but she did an excellent job in the state of Oregon leading an interagency group through the governor's office that looked at roles and responsibilities among state agencies and really did put together an action plan for how state agencies can cooperate and coordinate across the different responsibilities. I think it was a bit confusing to the public and even to state agencies at times who was on first in some situations. But we now do have, with the state
rail safety review, a very good roadmap and an action plan. We at ODOT are working to staff up adding additional rail inspectors and also clarifying the notification issues around hazardous materials. And so it'll be interesting to hear today from the other states on this panel and what they've done. I had a brief conversation with Representative Hornstein, and it sounds like Minnesota is dealing with some of the same issues and taking some of the same responses. So you'll get a good sense across the various states of how they're responding to these issues. What we're going to do is I'm just going to introduce by name all the folks on this panel, and then they're going to have 3 to 5 minutes to give some brief remarks. We'll just have them remain sitting, I think, is probably the easiest, and we'll just go through the list as it's listed on the agenda. We'll start with Matthew Brewer, who's with the Federal Railroad Administration, from the regional office here. Then we will have Chris Field from EPA Region 10 speak to us. After that, we'll have State Representative Frank Hornstein of Minnesota talk about what his state is doing in this area. Then Thomas Cullen, the administrator with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, speak. And then Dale Jensen will once again wrap things up. After that, we'll have some time for questions and be able to have a little bit more discussion if we have time. So with that, I will turn it over to Matthew to lead the way.
Good morning. How about now?
Yep.
As they say on Verizon, can you hear me now? As they said, I'm Matt Brewer, Deputy Regional Administrator for Region 8 for the Federal Railroad Administration. And I'll just give you a real brief synopsis of who we are in the FRA. You know, we're the Federal Railroad Administration, a relatively tiny agency in the grand scope of government. We have just under 900 employees nationwide. In comparison, one of our sister agencies, FAA, they have somewhere around 52,000. Comparing apples to apples, though, I guess I should, it's fair to say we have about 350 rail safety inspectors in the nation, and they have 4,300 aviation safety inspectors. So in comparison, we're tiny, and we kind of like it that way, but we have a new mission with the President's high-speed rail initiatives coming down. We're doing things that we never did before. We're handing out money, which I guess people like, but it caused us to sort of move in a different direction. We have a RPD division that we didn't used to have. So that's posed some challenges in recent years, but I think we're moving along nicely with that. And we did change our mission statement, and I'm going to read it so that I don't mess it up, even though I have it memorized. The Federal Railroad Administration enables the safe, reliable, and efficient movement of people and goods for a strong America now and in the future. So you'll see that there's some key components. Pretty much once upon a time, we really only focused on safety. Now you've got some other elements in here with efficiency and reliability. Those are components of the President's high-speed rail initiatives that are playing into it. And probably some of the other things we deal with rail capacity limits, moving freight, things that typically weren't in our purse, and really probably are still part of the Surface Transportation Board's purse, but how other goods get moved besides just maybe coal or oil, which seem to be the flavors of the week. So some of those things we don't really address, but we're dabbling in that just a bit. But safety is still our number one priority and has been. Over the past decade, as you saw from the chart, through partnerships with our state partners, the railroads, the labor unions, and outside contract companies developing different technology, we've driven a 47% reduction in rail accidents in the past decade, which is a huge phenomenon, truthfully. That's a huge reduction, 47%. A lot of it's been through, like I said, through partnerships. We have partnerships with presently with 30 and maybe soon to be 31. North Dakota is considering, at least there's legislation for them to develop a state inspector program. And so in those 30 states that we have partnerships with, and by the way, California, Oregon, Washington, they're all states that we have partnerships with. The states will have their own inspectors, which they hire. We train and qualify, and then they carry forth the authority to enforce our regulations as well. So those are good things. But we've also driven down a 59% reduction in rail fatalities for on-duty employees, which is another big thing. But lastly, I want to say, and this won't be a very popular message, but as you were already told, the regulations for hazardous materials are PHMSA's regulations, the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. They're the ones that do the tank car design standards, not us, not FRA. We enforce them, but they're responsible for the design and the regulations regarding hazardous material shipments in all modes, by via ship, rail, truck, every way. So, you know, some of the questions that you may have regarding those things, I wouldn't be able to answer them. And then this is the really unpopular part, as there was a notice of proposed rulemaking that's closed now, so this is really bad timing. But anything and everything that would have been involved in those new rules regarding the shipment of hazardous materials, the tank car design standards, crew size, all of those things on that list, I am prohibited from speaking about until they actually draft the rule. They tell me, or at least our public affairs department tells me, that's a prohibited ex parte communication. So I know that that's not a very popular message. They told me that, they said, October 1st, huh? That's really bad timing, because you're not going to be able to say a lot. So anyway, with that, I've probably taken up my 3 or 5 minutes, and I'll turn it over, and then we'll have room for questions afterwards, and I'll do my best. Thank you.
Good morning. Chris Field with EPA Region 10, and Region 9 is also here, and I think the comments I'll say for EPA probably cover a lot of EPA regions where this the rail, crude by rail issue is now much more prominent. I think, and by the way, Chris Field, I manage the EPA Emergency Management Program Region 10, and I also co-chair Region 10 Regional Response Team. So I think there's two main concerns for EPA. You know, one is the shift in the way that crude oil is moved around the country, clearly. And then the second is the light sweet crude that has different properties than the Alaskan crude that we're used to here in the Northwest. So those are the two, I think, EPA concerns. Probably fair to say that at EPA we long for the days when most of the crude oil is moved around in the Coast Guard zone. And we offered Coast Guard the inland, the jurisdiction over inland waters. We're still waiting to hear back from them on that. I'm not sure if they're going to accept that. And I was challenged by these new risks until I heard the Red Hill situation in Pearl Harbor this morning. And so good luck with that. At least we don't have that. Anyway. I'm going to just touch briefly on EPA actions at the national level, the regional level, within the RRT, and then within our backup regions group, and I'll explain that in a minute. Clearly, the Department of Transportation has the responsibility for prevention, and EPA has the responsibility for preparedness and response with respect to crude oil spills that affect navigable waters. So at the national level, EPA has formed a work group that involves each region, and the notion behind the work group is to make sure we're incorporating Bakken oil threats into our area planning processes. And so the work group is monitoring that, as well as making sure that all the regions get together and share information about getting better prepared for the new risks associated with the movement of that oil. At the regional level, you know, we are updating our area contingency plans to reflect the new risks posed by the Bakken oil, and particularly the increase in potential for a spill because of the rail traffic. We are doing a lot of training and information sharing with local and state responders. We have a leg up on that because we hired a on-scene coordinator from our Region 6 office in Texas, and he was weaned on the light sweet crew that we're seeing ship through the region now. So he's been really active out there training with firefighters, hazmat responders, and that kind of thing, sharing information in both directions, us providing to them and also hearing what they have to offer. And the other thing we're doing is we're involving the Bakken oil scenarios in a lot more of our exercises, tabletops, drills, all of those things, so that we just get more accustomed to sharing information and figuring out how the response tactics might have to change. At the regional response team level, there's a number of things that are emerging for us right now. We have the executive order on hazardous chemicals, safety and security, and as well as the Bakken oil issues. So myself and the Coast Guard co-chair are going to start reaching out more to the state emergency response commissions, the LEPCs, and the tribal emergency response commissions, and just making sure that we're sharing information as well as possible across those organizations. And it's necessary to do that because of the new threats posed by the oil transport, as well as those other emerging items that I mentioned. I think there's a couple of things in Region 10 that are maybe somewhat unique. I mean, maybe West Coast in general, and not just Region 10, but when you have oil spills to inland waters, there's a lot of hydroelectric power generation that occurs. And so if you have a spill in a river, there's a lot of urgency and concern about keeping oil out of those hydroelectric dams. That's something that we have to focus on very clearly now. There's a lot of cultural resource issues about how aggressively you can go after a spill when there's a lot of First Nation concerns there. And then there's a lot of economic concerns. If there's a dam, a hydroelectric dam, or other things that have to be shut down, then that poses all kinds of economic concerns as well. So we're trying to look at all of that and use that to prioritize how much work we do on the Bakken oil issue. And then the last point then is on the backup regions. Within EPA, we have what's called the National Approach to Response that's been around since the 9/11 days. And what it does is it takes the 10 EPA regions and groups them into smaller groups where we train and exercise and prepare together and prepare to support each other during a spill. So regions 8, 9, and 10 work up together as backup regions, and we'll be sharing information and making sure we take good ideas and spread them around the region, and then we'll prepare to support each other if there is a spill and that support is needed. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm State Representative Frank Hornstein from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I'm very honored to be here. I love this part of the country, so it's great to see all the great work that the task force is doing, and to be able to bring back to my state a lot of these great ideas that I'm hearing today. We in Minnesota did pass legislation this past legislative session in 2014. Our session went from January to May, so we're now not meeting. And we're hoping that this bill will just be a start to really addressing the issue in a very comprehensive way. And so in my limited time, I just wanted to go through some of the highlights of the bill and how it was developed. And obviously we can take your questions if you have them, after our presentations. And I did prepare a handout, which is out on the outside there at the registration table. It's entitled Crude by Rail Transportation in Minnesota, and then it has some just very brief summaries that are different agencies involved in the bill prepared. I only did 30. I thought task force, that's probably 30 people. So I didn't realize that we'd have such a thing. Like, it's not, a task force isn't really 5 or 10, but it's not 100 or 200. So our legislation really was prompted by, in large part, the accident in Castleton, North Dakota. That's just 20 miles to the west of the Minnesota border. So as you can imagine, that was a very large news story, and there was a lot of concern because that train was headed to one of the trains involved in the collision was headed to Minnesota, carrying the Bakken crude. And then we had the series of different federal responses to that. And we had a short legislative session this year. It was really an election year, so we usually just do a capital bonding bill and go home. There's not a lot of activity. We did have a surplus, so we had to figure out how we were going to spend that little bit of surplus money. So it wasn't really a legislative session where, quote unquote, big ideas were going to be discussed. But you know, myself and a couple of other people were feeling that we needed to actually address this. There was a real urgency. So we convened a meeting with three different state agencies: the Minnesota Department of Transportation, obviously this is a transportation issue; the Department of Public Safety, because of the emergency response implications to this question; and then the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, because of spill response and cleanup. And I'm not that much of a veteran in politics. My background's actually in community organizing, but I had never seen this kind of an interagency collaboration so quickly. Within a month, all three of these agencies met with myself and the Senate author and the governor's office, and we were able, in a week or two, to cobble together a pretty technical bill, not without controversy, of course. Anytime oil is involved, there's controversy. Each agency had a section of the bill. MnDOT, the transportation folks, we were dealing with rail grade crossing safety on oil train routes. We needed to hire more track inspectors. In Minnesota, we have 4,500 miles of track. We had one state track inspector. So as a result of the bill, now we have two additional inspectors and a hazmat inspector. We appropriated $2 million for rail grade crossing improvements where there are oil trains. And of course, that's a drop in the bucket because there are many, many more rail grade crossings involving oil trains. We have eight trains per day coming through Minnesota from North Dakota. We're at this geographic epicenter of this problem because many of the rail lines coming from North Dakota through Minnesota are going to refineries to the east and the south. But it wasn't just about rail, it was also about pipelines, because we have a major pipeline project coming through our state with carrying tar sands oil and some Bakken oil as well, proposed by Enbridge Company. So we wanted to make sure that both rail transportation and pipelines were included in the legislation. The Pollution Control Agency was responsible for a portion of the bill involving timely spill cleanup. As all of you know, it's so important to get at that problem right away. And one of the problems with the Enbridge spill in Kalamazoo was the amount of time it took to get the booms and all of the equipment and response needed to clean that up. So we were very aware of that issue. And finally, the Department of Public Safety came with the need for additional resources for first responders in terms of training. This is a whole new, we kept hearing, we had firefighters and emergency response folks, we kept hearing from them that this is a whole new ballgame. We don't really know how to deal with this. The Commissioner of Public Safety said at a hearing before my committee, I chair the Transportation Finance Committee, she said, this keeps our people up at night. And when you say that on the public record, it gets people's attention. So I'll just conclude by saying that amazingly, most of the elements of this bill that I've described were ultimately passed into law. The politics of this were quite interesting. And that is that the railroad companies did come to the table and work with us. They had certain concerns that we addressed, some of those others we just couldn't compromise on, but they did not oppose the legislation. The pipeline companies strongly opposed it, and as a matter of fact, the Senate version of the bill, I'm in the House, the Senate version of the bill did not even mention pipelines at all. So that was an interesting conference committee, right? The House version was comprehensive, the Senate version only had railroads. And, you know, the governor intervened and we were able to get some language related to first responder training as it relates to pipelines. And we have an assessment on railroads and pipelines to pay for that. So the pipelines are involved in that assessment. But they were not involved in the spill response language. And I'll just conclude by saying this is what the pipelines oppose. This is what the pipeline companies, to the bitter end in the final negotiation would never agree to, and this is why it was not included in the legislation. And keep in mind the railroad companies did. So here's one. You know, within an hour of confirmation of a discharge, a railroad, and then it doesn't say pipeline because they're not included, must provide a qualified company employee to advise the incident commander, public sector incident commander on the scene. The employee may be made available by telephone and must be authorized to deploy all necessary response resources of the railroads. So this is just simply making a phone call. Making a phone call an hour after a spill to an incident commander on the scene. I have no idea why that is so onerous. And then, I can go on and on. Then we had some requirements that, within 3 hours they would be on scene. That's just having a doctor on call, right? You're on call, you can get there within 3 hours. No way. They did not want to do that. The railroads agreed to it. So I will, this is going, I sent the copy of the entire legislation to Sarah, and I think that's going to be put on the web for you to look at, and I would be happy to answer any questions about our bill. It's a start. We have over 3 years now between public and private resources, about $13.5 million committed to this comprehensive strategy of training, equipping first responders, rail grade crossing infrastructure improvements, track inspectors, there's additional staffing for the Pollution Control Agency to deal with the spill response piece of this. There's some drills involved. The EPA talked about drills. We also have a drill requirement for the railroads, pipelines excluded, from first responders. So, again, thank you so much for inviting me and involving me in this really important discussion.
Well, hello again from the state of California. So you saw in my slides a little earlier about what we did, how we identified the threat to our state's resources from oil, anywhere it moves, anywhere it's stored. And we had a challenge when we used rail to kind of springboard the discussion to identify the gaps in our protection for the whole state. And that was to limit it just to the commodity. We didn't want to, zero in on rail. We used it to try to get the discussion going. And Governor Brown, when he gave his State of the State back in January, and then subsequently, rolled out his 2014-2015 budget, he was very conversant. He understood the threat. We got the discussion going. We were very heavy, as you saw in my presentation earlier, on trying to capture and frame the issue in visuals. And so with a very proven, robust 23-year test and re program, we designed it almost looked like a target. I wanted to describe a nucleus with protective rings around it. And we had the outer ring being prevention, next ring preparedness, the middle ring being response. And on the ring side, we were pretty much well protected in the state through the partnerships we developed with the Coast Guard and State Lands Commission and so forth. We showed the gaps, though, on the inland portion of the state. We heard from FRA with their limited resources in inspections and very little in preparedness, response not having resources. And so the governor and his executive team convened a work group to look at rail, and they reported out in June with several recommendations, which have subsequently been implemented. Authorization to hire new rail inspectors, placarding, to call for higher standards of rail car and so forth. But one of the big challenges for us in Department of Fish and Wildlife as trustees of natural resources has been to basically protect what we asked for. So with that 6.5 cent per barrel expansion going statewide, that would bring us, because of the volumes we're talking about, approximately $11 million more in revenue for our program. Most of that would go toward hiring about 38 new positions, mainly scientists, additional game wardens that could go and be the first ones on the ground to start an investigation, safety personnel that will now know not just ship design and ship characteristics, but inland production and pipeline and perhaps highway aspects. And most of these folks are going to be in the field. We're going to open a new field office smack in the middle of the Central Valley, where there's tens of thousands of active wells, going into pipeline, eventually making their way to refineries. So it's very much designed for protecting the resource, the habitat, the species, the waters of the state. Well, we're successful in getting the, into the governor's budget, passing after a lot of, contentious debate and hearings and justification of our program. But one of the perils, of course, is when you go and you get new money, you become everybody else's best friend. And we had a lot of folks knocking at the door. I was asked to appear before many hearings, and I look out in the room and I see a sea of fire chiefs and the concern about, first responder and public safety. And it's very, very difficult to sit up here looking out there and saying, well, it's not my job. By law, I'm responsible for the resource, and we argued for this amount of money. We kept it fairly low. I mean, 6.5 cents per barrel really comes out to a one sixth of a penny per $4 gallon of gas. It's a very small amount, imperceptible, really at the pump. But, it's for our program to protect resources. We do have some local grants for training, about $1.5 million worth for going out and helping train first responders in the hazards related to petroleum spills, providing some equipment. But thank goodness, my colleagues at the California Department of California Office of Emergency Services recognized the need to protect what we had argued for, to protect the resource, and they went and then inserted an addendum to the governor's budget to provide a $10 million fund for hazardous material training and equipment. So those aspects, filling in that circle of the protective and preparedness and response, shields, if you will, to take care of the local responders and the public safety. So it's been a very interesting thing for us to experience here in California, and I'm delighted to have been a part of it. A massive amount of work on the parts of many other folks besides me and across different agencies. We've learned to, the different relationships. As I mentioned, on the marine side was mainly Coast Guard and a couple other locals, NGOs and so forth. Now we're developing new relationships, with like the California Public Utility Commission, which would be the state version of the FRA, and that's where there's going to be, perhaps a dozen new inspectors coming in that will exercise FRA authorities and inspections, trying to find those breaks in the welds and the things we saw on the slide. The PHMSA equivalent for on the pipeline side of the state would be the state fire marshal on the prevention side. Of course, California Office of Emergency Services and the National Response Plan and the integration of all the activities related to an event. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, a lot of regulations to roll out. Just identifying the pool of plan holders is quite a challenge. We have one group dedicated just trying to identify the definition of state waters, especially when in these drought conditions, and it's not evident from geographic, topographical features of the land. Could this be a waterway? If you spill here, could it potentially affect the waters of the state? So with that, I'll look forward to the questions for you, Travis, and anybody else in the audience, and thanks again.
Hello again. I will try not to repeat, what everybody has said. I think we're facing, many of the same challenges and on the same track as we're sitting here this morning. Our governor is making his public announcement on the path forward. We had to deliver our preliminary studies to him, so we briefed him day before yesterday, and he's in Seattle doing a press conference right now. So now I can share with you, you're the first audience to hear the things that we are looking to move forward in this legislative session. I did bring about 100 pages of our focus sheet, and so Kathy will set them, on the table out and back if people are interested. There's a web link there. The reports posted to our webpage. The focus sheet is there, and so you can take a look at it. But basically, there are a couple things. So the governor is, as public safety is, you know, paramount of importance. He's really wanting to do something immediately. He's signed, put his pen to the federal rulemaking yesterday, asked his agencies to compile comments. We coordinated, you know, throughout our state agencies on what we think changes could be made on the two federal rulemaking that's going on around safer cars, speeds, training, planning, all those types of things. So he's putting that forward as a strong ask of the federal agencies to accelerate, you know, what they're doing. He's also at the same time, Senator Murray, who's at the federal congresswoman, is also pretty active in this work. So they're working closely together on what they can do to encourage stronger federal action. You know, our response posture too, he really feels that prevention is really, safety and prevention are really the game here. And in our state, we've on the response side, on the prevention side, I really focused on prevention from the big time and working with our regulated community and also ensuring a rapid, aggressive, well-coordinated response posture. We've had that in place for years. Quick action, quick notifications, proper notifications, proper information is going to get the response underway, contain the source, make sure that people are safe and well-informed. He has two directives. There was a, you know, I talked earlier about the proviso language that came out of the legislature, and then he wanted quicker action. So he had two directives that are in addition to the proviso. I'll talk about the proviso results in a minute. But there were two pieces that he wanted in addition, and it really was around the funding piece with the changing dynamics of the picture. You know, how can we ensure that we have good and stable funding that can support what's needed at the state level from the agency standpoint, and what types of help we could, you know, do at the local level as well. The other part of that was, as I think others have talked about, was really the Utilities and Transportation Commission on railroad crossings, inspections, more inspectors, you know, looking at fee increases that can help fund more inspections, getting clear authority from the federal Railroad Administration on what inspectors can be able to do. Now, for the proviso results, UTC looking at clear authority for UTC inspectors to access private property, private shippers' properties, where there are railroad crossings within private shipper properties that could, you know, be of a concern. We also are looking at, I mentioned earlier about some of the asks. So we have had last session for geographic response planning, risk assessment work, not only the rail side, but the vessel side. So we're asking for ongoing permanent funding to be able to do that complete cycle of the work that needs to be done there. We'll be looking at funding requests around continuing to assess the transportation risks, not only on the vessel side. We've done a lot of work in the Salish Sea area between us and Canada. There's some more work that needs to be done there with the proposed projects. But the Grace Harbor community, there are three proposed facilities that are going in there, crude for the first time, Grace Harbor. The Columbia River, another area that we're hoping to get some resources to do some risk assessment work with our partners down here as well. And then the marine rail study that's been ongoing, there's just so many recommendations and additional ones that will continue to formulate before March 1st. We had about 40 recommendations. I'm talking about 12 here that will likely come forward in some type of legislation. Also, we had a very successful grant program in the 2006-2007 timeframe where we put in place all over the state over 100 local equipment caches through grants. We trained up our tribal partners, our local first responder partners, just to initiate the early action on the response can help contain the source. And then as we cascade in our other response assets, We're looking to expand that. It's been a highly successful program. We're looking at expanding that, and even in expanding it to first responders. So looking at the possibility of pre-positioning firefighting foam trailers, equipment that will aid our local community first responders, additional training. I know our the railroads are doing a lot of training, others are doing a lot of training, EPA and others at the local level, but more training. We're hearing more of that. So that'll be part of that particular package. There is also the local emergency planning groups. I mean, you can imagine, you know, some of the small communities, especially in eastern, you know, Washington, where they just really don't have the resources. You know, their plans are either not existent or, not kept up. So there's some work that's going to be done, possibly some funding that can really help with the local emergency planning communities to get their plans up to speed. So they know what to do within the community if they were to have an unfortunate event. So there's UTC's also looking at the ability to do more diagnostic reviews of high-risk crossings. That might be something that you will hear if you happen to see the outcome of the governor's statements today. He's really focused on, you know, areas that the state can focus on because of the federal preemption issues. We're really looking at how we can push our authorities as far as we can at the state level and really ensure the highest level of safety. We also are looking at clarifying our definition of facility in the state. Right now, we have authority with the railroad transfers at a facility, so vessel transfers, mobile transfers, at a facility with five refineries and some other proposed transfer sites that I talked about. But we're looking at clarifying our facility definition that will allow us to impose contingency plans on railroads and transit as California has done and Minnesota has done some of their work. So it's been very, very helpful to look at some of the work that California and Minnesota have done and then see how we can expand that. We're looking at more information, you know, even though there's high-level information being provided to the states on when rail come in. One of the very strong debates last legislative session was more information. On the marine side, we have advanced notice of transfer information. We know the volume, we know the type of product, we know when it's going to be transferred, we know everything that we need to know on the marine side. We're looking at expanding that data, advanced notice of transfer, to the railroad side and to the pipeline side, so that we'll have a complete picture as this information continues to change. The emerging risk picture, we'll know exactly what kind of products are coming in. And it's not just about crude oil, it's oil, our definition of oil. So that our definition of oil will apply to most of these asks. On the marine side, we have best achievable protection, best achievable technology. So we'll be applying that, seeking authority to apply that, you know, inland as well. We want the best technology, we want the best capability on the inland side as well. We really do have a goal of having our inland side be as stellar, you know, as our marine side. Financial responsibility requirements apply to the vessel side. We have authority on the facility side now. We're looking at clarifying the authority that we need that would apply to rail. So financial responsibility requirements for railroads coming through our state. So it's not only railroads operating within our state, but it's also railroads that are carrying product from Canada through our state to Oregon or California, from North Dakota, Montana, you know, through our state to Oregon or California. We're looking at in-transit applications there. The last part of the 12 recommendations is the evaluation of geographic hazardous hazmat teams, so that have, you know, much broader capability than we have, you know, even on the oil side. So that's some work that we'll be doing with the state fire marshals office. We did some work several years ago. It'll be to refresh that and look at what kinds of teams are possible in putting in geographic locations. So I think that's pretty much it for me.
Thank you. Thanks to all of you. I have a few questions that I think I'll lob out to the group, and then we will have hopefully a few minutes for questions from the audience as well. One of the things that is most important in all this, obviously, is just preventing oil spills in the first place. So I'd like to ask Matt a little bit about the direction that has come from USDOT to shippers about the legacy tank cars. We've heard a lot in the media about the DOT 111s, and there was sort of a safety advisory without, I think, a lot of real firm regulatory direction. Has that had an impact on the movement of crude by rail? Are we starting to see fewer shippers using those DOT 111s and using more modern tank cars to date?
I'm guessing you're talking about the voluntary... Essentially, the railroads and the shippers, they prefer dedicated service, dedicated equipment. They like their trains to stay all together. It's safer, it's easier, less switching, those types of things. So the natural progression would be for them to easily comply with this as those cars become available, the newer standard cars or the newer design. So overall, at least from our region and our regional level, we have seen a reduction in the sort of the old workhorse, the 111s, with exception of, if they've got a dedicated unit train, let's say 107 cars or something like that, somebody's purchased 107 cars of oil, they're going to ship them 107 cars, the shipper is. So if at, say, that load facility or somewhere they found a problem with a car or two and they have to set that car out of that train, they're going to replace it with other cars. And what we're seeing now is a lot of times what's available is the 111. So you'll have, by and large, 105 cars, the new design standard, and two, maybe the old standard 111s. But the short answer is overall, yes, we have seen a reduction in the 111s, at least from our region.
Okay. Good. A question I'd like to get to Tom and to Dale as well. There are a lot of players in this arena at the state government level, transportation regulators, environmental regulators, public safety groups as well. To what extent have you seen good interagency collaboration between different state agencies, and to what extent might there still be some barriers of having all the different players at the table, but perhaps some confusion about roles and responsibilities or at least areas that may not be covered?
Sure. I think that it's been amazing how the agencies have come together. People are really concerned. The public is really concerned. I mean, I think it was Dick that mentioned, thousands of people are showing up for every single, possible public hearing or meeting where they can express, their concern. So the agencies are really getting it, and they're working very, very hard. I think the amazing thing about it too is that everybody is really working hard at looking at what their role is and what their clear authority is, not only at the state level, but then, as I said earlier, bumping up against the federal level. A lot of really good collaboration. So I'm seeing some very, very positive things coming out of this, and actually, one of the things we're not sure about, there are a number of agencies that have been high expectations of the governor. We work together. He may decide to put forward his own legislation this year that would be a package of multiple agencies if that happens. And that would be the first time that I've seen that.
Thanks, Sam. I'll echo what Dale said, and I would probably break it down from the policy development side. There's been a remarkable coming together of state agencies, our federal partners, representatives from the affected 58 counties in the state. But this is in the planning phases. We're going, and we recognize there has to be a win. That we have this threat, and we have to come together and work together. And there's not the pressure of an actual event, an incident out there. And as we go and we start doing the tabletops and and you know, here's a scenario, here's a situation. That's when we start identifying some of the concerns, and we really need to work more on more of these kinds of events. You know, starting with the tabletops and then equipment deployments, you know, notification drills, and then you know, probably the full scale exercises, looking at all the various aspects. We have to win the trust of the local certified unified public agencies, the COOPAs, and the local fire. There was a concern when we pointed out that by state law, I, as the administrator, am the state's unseen coordinator for oil spills, and that was misinterpreted that, you know, I was going to come in and try to direct firemen and how they fight a fire, and we had to, you know, reassure them, no. Public safety, the fighting the fire, all that, you know, we recognize that you invented ICS, we respect that. We're going to come in parallel with you and work on trying to contain, minimize the effects of this bill, protect the resource, and then jump into NERDA. So that's, I think, where it's going to be the true test, is when we start working together when the pressure's on.
I just wanted to comment briefly on this question, and that is, in the last month, our governor, Governor Mark Dayton, held five different listening sessions all across the state, where all three of the commissioners came with him, the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, the commissioner of Public Safety, the commissioner of the Department of Transportation, and then they invited local mayors, city council people, county commissioners, first responders. There were, you know, these uniformed firefighters and police officers and EMT folks at all of these meetings. It was amazing. I've never seen anything quite like it, that the governor would take it this seriously and then all of these people would be coming together. So I do think there is something about this issue that has really mobilize public interest and public concern. The congressman from I just got an email this morning that the congressman from my district, that covers Minneapolis and suburbs of Minneapolis, is going to have a public forum on oil rail safety on October 15th, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of people there. And he told me that he went around to these suburban city councils to find out what was on their mind. And he said five of the six said this issue was the top one. So, you know, this is going to require, and so far I think we've had examples of unprecedented collaboration in my experience among these agencies. And I'm glad your governor is now involved, and as has ours for the last, you know, for the last year, he's made this a very high priority. You know, to the point that we've had these, you know, tours that we should have, like T-shirts, you know, oil listening session tour 2014, you know, because we'd have all these cities listed, you know, because then he's got a few more plants. So it's really been an amazing experience.
We got about 15 minutes left, so if you have a question, please raise your hand. I think Hillary will come around with a microphone, and she can then have you answer your question to the group.
Hello.
Thank you. This question is for Mr. Jensen from Washington DOE. This past session in the Washington legislature, a Rail Transportation Safety Act failed. Made it through the House. The Senate apparently wasn't interested.
What is the Senate?
Sounds familiar, doesn't it? I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on what is it going to take for some of these recalcitrant state senators to get on board with something that ought to be a no-brainer.
There were a lot of really good policy recommendations and debates and discussions last session, and it was disappointing that we didn't get, you know, more out of it. What I will say is that there has been a lot of work between legislative officials, I think over the summer, legislative staff, and the governor is He's calling out to them. He's meeting, you know, with them, and he has very, very high expectations that they will work together and they will pass something, you know, this year. So I can't speculate so much on the past, but I'm hopeful and encouraged that something will happen this session.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks. Doug Helton from NOAA. I noticed that a lot of the voluntary information by the rail industry promotes safety reforms for cars or trains that have more than 20 cars. And I was wondering if that is going to lead to a kind of a two-tiered system where unit trains have one rule of safety, but you know you could have 20 cars and still have over 500,000 gallons of oil in a car and have none of these provisions that the industry is promoting for these larger unit trains.
That's probably stepping into the area that I'm probably not really allowed to talk about, but your comment sounds correct. If that answers it.
I can add that from here in Oregon, we're looking at the rules related to movement of hazardous materials by rail, by any type of hazardous material, and looking at modernizing our regulations in that regard so that it would capture all of the hazardous materials movement. And there's questions about whether we need pre-notification of movement into the state, whether we should look at post-notification. But the main point is to make sure the first responders, emergency responders, have all the information they need about what is moving. We have a rulemaking advisory committee that's working through that, and what seems to be coming out in talking to the emergency responders, they don't necessarily want all that information flowing to them on a real-time basis, but they do want access to what's on those trains, what's known as the consist from the railroads. And I know the AAR, the American Association of Railroads, is working on providing that access. Other questions?
My name is Noah Hockman. I'm with the Public Laboratory for Open Technology and Information, as well as Portland Rising Tide. And I was wondering, ignoring, I guess, political feasibility, what are some of the legal options on a moratorium?
Is there any particular member of the panel you'd like to address that to?
Hearing from the senator or maybe some of the state agencies, I think, I'm sure they're aware of some mechanisms that they might have. Whether or not it can be implemented, I would just like to know what some of the options could be.
So the question is, if I understand it correctly, what political or legal options might there be for declaring a moratorium on the movement of crude by rail?
The only thing I can think of is maybe, if the governor has certain emergency powers under
your
state statute.
Can you say that again?
Sorry. This is just a very general answer to a general question, but the one thing that came to mind in terms of whether a state would have the power to do a moratorium on transfer of crude by rail until there are sufficient rules in place is if the governor had some sort of emergency powers in a particular state that would allow the governor to do that. Mm-hmm.
From the state of Oregon's perspective, the research we have done and extensive conversations with the Oregon Department of Justice indicate that a very significant portion of our regulatory authority that may approach nearly 100% would be preempted by multiple federal laws that govern the movement of just about every commodity by rail, including hazardous materials. So to date, the state's role in this looks to be very narrow, primarily around the area of prevention and preparedness and response.
And I think for the state of Washington, it's the same way. I mean, that was the expectation of the governor. You know, the first things he came out with, even a year ago, and just in our meetings, well, can I stop this? Until we get the safety system kind of in place? And it really is, as Travis has said, it's most everything around rail is federally preempted. It's very difficult to do something like you're asking.
I would concur with all of those comments, and we had to. Also, really research what exactly could the state do. It's reflective of what the folks in Oregon and Washington have been telling you. But I'll tell you, there are so many problems, I think, that need to be addressed at the federal level. And one that really is always been a recurring one for me and for those of us who are concerned about safety is the fact that the railroad companies have an exemption from the Community Safety and Right to Know Act. And so, you know, that's a real problem when our first responders and our communities don't even have the ability to find out what's being transported through their communities. And so, you know, we inserted that in our bill. And then, you know, again, we were immediately threatened with, if that goes in, you're going to get a, you know, there'll be a lawsuit. And, you know, now I'm kind of willing to test the waters a little bit. I think we need to test the, you know, as state legislators and state agencies, really test how far we can go with all of this, because I'm not terribly optimistic that at least with this current Congress we're going to get a lot of, you know, progress on things like community right to know. But I just, you know, again, here's the headlines of in the Wall Street Journal today. Oil firm, you know, the obligatory picture of Castleton, of course. Oil firms, railroads fight new rules. So, you know, they're saying that they don't even want to phase out these DOT 111 cars in 7 years. I think they should be phased out now. The, you know, DOT is saying 2 years. So this is the kind of fight that, you know, that we're up against at the federal level.
We probably have time for one or two more questions.
My question is to all panelists. Concerning the organization of response and coordination, and an analogy is like it's in marine area, ships like Clean Rivers Cooperative here in Oregon or Marine Spill Response Corporation globally, meaning that railroad companies kind of involved in equipment preparedness and positioning and resources and maybe like certain financial obligations like in the ships for the coordinated response. No? Let's say there is a spill, there is some small local contractor, the only one who deals with the containment and cleanup.
One of the things that we talked, you know, kind of along that line for the last, I would say, you know, we've always responded to rail incidents. So over the years, it's become, you know, much more collaborative. I would say even in the past few years, the last 2 or 3 years, we started doing a lot of work with BNSF especially and Union Pacific and bringing them into our area committee work. And they've been very, very engaged in our work. There's certainly lots of room to grow, but they've been part of developing geographic response, you know, plans, providing that information in. They do have response contractors that respond to their incidents. I'm sure that they'll talk more about that in their panel this afternoon, so that would be a good question for them. But there is a system. It's just we believe there's, you know, room for improvement there.
This might be the question we make our concluding comments, right? Or is there going to be an opportunity for that?
Yeah, I think this is probably the time to about wrap
okay.
up.
Okay, well, I mean, I would just say that, you know, again, we have limited jurisdiction in the state. So one of the things we had in our bill that passed, and again, I'd encourage folks to talk to me because I think this is a good piece of legislation that was supported, you know, ultimately by the House, Senate, and signed by the governor. And I think it's a start. We don't have enough resources in this bill currently, and we need to get more. But your question about coordination is a good one. And we have very specific protocols for coordination and mutual aid in our bill. And I think that's a key part of the, you know, section of the Department of Public Safety wrote. So, you know, again, I want to just thank Sarah and the task force for the invitation here. And I think we should do something like this in the Midwest. We don't have a lot of shoreline, although we have the Great Lakes. But and there is actually a proposal potentially to ship tar sands oil out of Superior, Wisconsin, onto Lake Superior, which will be quite controversial. But I think this is a great model, and it's I'm really, you know, energized and inspired by the work that you're doing. So thank you very much.
So let's thank the panel for their time today. Any other who would like to respond to that particular question?
Well, I don't know about that question, but I did want to say thank you for the invitation. And as you see, this is a complex issue with lots of entities. I think we've actually all worked well together. I've been working with the state of Washington on their team. but from our side, and not to oversimplify it, but we really believe that reducing the accidents and eliminating them or preventing them altogether sort of answers all the questions. If you don't have derailments, then you don't have to worry about which car it's in. You don't have to worry about a release. You don't have to worry about a response. So a lot of the areas that we're driving in are in the prevention side, because if you prevent the accident, I mean, I know that's a simple way to put it, but that's something that we feel like we actually have some regulatory teeth in and some oversight. So hopefully we can continue to partner with the states. I did want to say we especially appreciate the states that do have inspector affiliation programs with us, which is 30, because they supplement our 350 inspectors by a third. So, you know, we certainly want that. More eyes is better. So anyway, thank you, and thank you to the states.
Chris, Tom, any final comments? If not, we will now, let's thank our panel and close up.
As promised, we're going to just do a quick transition to our keynote speaker, and so I'll let the gentleman here exit the stage. And I want to thank Travis, too, for stepping in at the last minute. And Travis, it was like you've been prepared for a month for this, so really, really appreciate that. So thank you very much. So while we're pulling up the slides here, I do want to take a moment to introduce our keynote today. And quite frankly, we're really, really pleased to have him here. Rick Wyan is currently Vice President of Logistics for Tesoro Corporation and Vice President for Operations for Tesoro Logistics. Looking back at your career at Tesoro, Rick, you've covered a lot and held a lot of vice president positions, so that's a good thing. And it covers all of this is in the bio, but I just want to take one minute to express the breadth of knowledge and experience that Rick has. He's held vice president positions for regional development for Mid-Continent Renewable Energy, for alternative fuels, for development for North America, for capital management, in lots of other positions at Tesoro since 2001. And before that, Rick has lots of experience in the industry. And so with that, we are very, very pleased to have you, Rick. And thank you so much for taking the time and spending time and sharing with us your experience. Really appreciate that.
Great. Thank you, Rick. All right. Thank you for the introduction. And again, this is an honor for me to be here because the intent of this meeting is something that's really important. I mean, obviously, you know, keeping the oil contained, avoiding incidents, avoiding spills is absolutely critical. It's a major focus of everything we do. But it's equally important to be ready to respond in case there is an unfortunate incident and be ready to minimize the impact of it should it happen. So I appreciate the effort and the work that's going on here. And what I really want to do is kind of focus on, you know, why is all this necessary? Why is this crude by rail happening? And really, hopefully, illuminate a little bit about how good this is for the United States, all the benefits that are coming out of this energy renaissance, which has resulted in the crude by rail world that's happening now. So what I do quickly is first touch on Tesoro and Tesoro Logistics, then really talk about this energy renaissance and what's been going on in terms of domestic oil production, and then finally touch a little bit on our Vancouver Energy Distribution Terminal we're working on here. So to start with, Tesoro is a Fortune 100 company. We're one of the larger independent oil refiners in the U.S. We have a total capacity in our six refineries of about 850,000 barrels a day. As you can see, about 700,000 barrels of that is along the West Coast, so we're very involved in this area. We also have market gasoline through a bunch of different brands. We don't have a big national brand ourselves, but we use other brands, which you can see along the bottom in various marketing locations. Tesoro also is the owner of Tesoro Logistics, which I'll talk a little bit more about, which is basically a logistics company that's part of Tesoro. And one other point I'd like to make here looking at the map is Tesoro does operate in some of the most environmentally sensitive areas in the country. You can see us up in on the coast in Alaska and in Puget Sound, San Francisco Bay, Los Angeles. You know, we're used to operating in these type of sensitive areas. And how do we do that? It's really because we have safety and the environment as core values for the company. There's nothing more important for us as an operator to make sure that we're keeping our people safe, keeping the community safe, and protecting the environment where we operate. This is absolutely critical. We've shown the ability to do that, and we're continuously focused on it going forward. Tesoro Logistics is a master limited partnership that was spun off by Tesoro in 2011. It's wholly owned by Tesoro. It's controlled. The general partner is Tesoro. So it's really just a logistics arm for Tesoro Corporation. And the reason for that is it gives us, through the master limited partnership structure, the ability to do a lot of growth in order to make investments to increase the amount of logistics infrastructure out there to help support the energy development. And we've been doing that through really two methods. One, through acquisitions. For example, last year we purchased the Northwest Products Pipeline System, which is a pipeline that runs from refineries in Salt Lake City to supply Idaho as well as Pasco and Spokane with petroleum products. We also purchased a bunch of logistics assets associated with the ARCO Los Angeles, California system that we purchased from BP a year ago. But in addition to that, we're also investing in new infrastructure, new facilities. We're doing pipeline expansions, terminal expansions, wherever there are needs to have increased supply of fuels or crude oil. We're making investments to help support that need. So with that, the next thing I'd like to do is move over and talk a little bit about this domestic energy renaissance, as we call it, with maybe it sounds a little dramatic, but I think it really is appropriate in this case. And this is what really has driven a lot of this crude by rail that we're seeing. The first graph shows the shale oil production of the just the United States over the past couple years. And you see this boom really started about 2008, 2009 as a result of technology improvements where people were able to start extracting oil from some of these tight shale formations that weren't accessible in the past. As a result of this, we've seen a huge increase in domestic oil production, particularly in areas with this particular shale type resource, which we've heard about already, the Bakken in North Dakota, the Permian Basin in West Texas, the Eagle Ford Shale, as well as other areas kind of throughout the Mid-Continent area, Oklahoma, Colorado, and so forth. So as a result of all these developments, we've reversed a long-term trend in actually increasing the domestic oil production to the point that within the next year or two, we might actually surpass the all-time high of oil production that hit the United States back in 1970. Just an incredible turnaround. This next slide kind of takes it to a longer-term context. This goes all the way back to 1949, and you see that over history there's been one inevitable trend, which is the growth in that yellow line of imported crude oil coming into the United States. There were a few bobbles in the 70s with all of the various energy shocks, but in general the amount of imports has slowly grown to where in the middle of the last decade, something like 60% of the U.S. petroleum consumption was supplied by imported crude oil. Now, the remarkable thing is how in the last few years that's completely reversed. And you see with all of the spike up in the red line of the domestic crude oil production, it's been a huge decline in the amount of imported crude oil that's had to come into the United States. And this is really striking for a couple areas for a few reasons. One of them is just from an energy economic standpoint. In addition to the increase in crude oil production, the same type of technology has been used to increase natural gas production, particularly in places like the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania, where now there's excess natural gas. Natural gas prices in the United States are far less than any place else in the world, which gives the United States manufacturing base a great advantage. Where we might have higher labor costs than other countries, but by having lower energy costs, that makes it a lot more advantage, able for domestic manufacturers to overcome some of this labor potential cost and be able to still be competitive. And actually, their investments in things like petrochemicals that for years and years have been manufactured overseas, now they're actually investing to build plants in the U.S. because the feedstock and the energy supply is such that they can be cost competitive. A second factor is you should look at the number of barrels. If you can see, you know, roughly it's 5 million barrels a day less imported crude oil than in the United States than what we had 10 years ago, say. You know, if you multiply 5 million barrels a day times $100 a barrel, roughly, for crude oil, that's an awful big change. That's $500 million a day worth of improvement in the balance of payments as a result of being able to back off on this imported crude oil. Just a tremendous turnaround. And then the final comment on that is that you don't have to spend a lot of time watching the news with things going on in places like Russia and Iran, Iraq, places like that, to know that we'd sure rather be relying on places like North Dakota for crude oil than some of those places we've been buying it from as an alternative. Now, focusing in a little bit more, particularly on the West Coast, we see a pretty similar story for the most part, although if you go back 20, 30 years, the West Coast refining complex ran almost exclusively on local crudes, crude oil produced either in Alaska or the California production. But what's been happening, those fields, especially Alaska, but also California, have been in pretty steady rate of decline over the last 20 years with really no turnaround. This increase in domestic production that's happened in the Mid-Continent area hasn't hit the West Coast. Now, it's really been a Mid-Continent phenomenon with all this extra production, and places like Alaska and California are still declining in crude oil production. As a result, the refineries on the West Coast, in order to supply the product demand, have had to bring in increasing amounts of imported crude oil. Now, in the West Coast, it's been a lot from South America, a lot from the Middle East, and a lot from Asia, places like Russia. The one change, you can see a tiny little sliver in 2013 at the very end, where there's a little bit now that's shown up as being rail imported crude oil into the West Coast. The current estimate is right now there's about 150,000 barrels a day of crude oil that's being imported into the West Coast by rail, which out of over 1.5 million barrels, it's something like 1% to this point. So it's really very small to date in terms of the amount of crude oil that's being railed into the West Coast to supply the refineries here. So the question is, why is the West Coast insulated, relatively speaking, from crude by rail, and why is it going other places, and where is all this crude going? It really comes down to logistics. So we'll start on logistics by just looking at North Dakota in particular. Now, the state of North Dakota, if you go back 10 years, is producing less than 100,000 barrels a day of crude oil. And basically, most of that crude oil went into one refinery that existed. It's a Tesoro refinery in Mandan, North Dakota. The rest of it went on pipelines into Minneapolis and then elsewhere out into the refining sector. But then over the last several years, as the production started to ramp up very quickly in North Dakota, there was a rush to build infrastructure to handle the crude oil because all this crude oil had to go to market someplace. There's no place to take the crude oil in North Dakota to get rid of 1 million barrels a day of crude oil. You have to find a way to get it to refineries. So there are two potential alternatives. One, of course, is pipelines, and then the other alternative is rail. Well, pipelines have been very slow and very difficult to build for a couple reasons. First of all, permitting, right-of-way, that kind of stuff takes a long time for pipelines to get built. Probably even more of a deterrent, though, is pipelines, because they're so incredibly expensive, and we're talking tens of billions of dollars to build a pipeline out of North Dakota to get to someplace like the Gulf Coast where the refineries exist that would be able to run it. In order for any company to make that type of investment, they're going to need producers or customers, somebody to sign on with a long-term commitment that they will promise to ship 100,000 barrels a day on the pipeline and pay $5 barrel tariff for the next 20 years in order to give a pipeline company enough incentive, enough certainty to make the investment of these billions of dollars to put the pipeline in place. Now, with the going back to the last couple of graphs about how the world has changed so quickly in the last couple of years, there are no shippers out there right now that expressed the willingness to say, okay, I understand the world enough. I'm going to commit that I'm going to run 50,000 barrels a day of crude oil from North Dakota to my refinery in Texas and paid this much transportation for 10 years. Not enough people have been willing to make that commitment to fund any big pipelines. There are some pipelines getting built, as you can see by the little step-ups. For those of you who can't see the graph very well, the kind of purplish bar on top is rail offloading capability, or rail loading capability in North Dakota. The other ones are various pipeline capability or tranches of pipeline expansions to help move that crude oil out. So you see that there are pipeline projects getting built, but they tend to be slower and they've been very slow to develop. So in parallel, as the pipeline companies tried to build pipelines, a bunch of people went out and built rail loading facilities very quickly to be able to get this crude oil to market. A lot of these were built by the producers, where they knew they had to get the crude oil out to find a way to get to refineries. So they're investing to drill wells to produce the oil. They invested extra money to make sure they had rail facilities to be able to export the crude oil to get to market. And then there are other companies that were independent logistics companies that built rail loading facilities to help facilitate that movement. And what we found is as these rail facilities get built out, they've been very highly utilized, to the point that out of the million-plus barrels a day of crude oil that's being produced in North Dakota, somewhere around 500,000-700,000 barrels a day is being shipped out by rail consistently over the last year or two. And the reason for that, it's really a combination of the producers like it because they have more optionality on markets. They're not locked in. If they had a pipeline deal, they would have to go ship their crude and sell it to a customer in Texas or wherever the pipeline went, whereas by rail, they can choose their market. If prices are higher on the East Coast, they can rail it to the East Coast to a customer. Or if it's higher in Cushing, Oklahoma, with the big domestic crude oil hub there, they can go to Cushing with it. Or the West Coast, wherever the economics are better, they can go. And by the same token, refiners have optionality that they don't have to get locked in and buy crude from, say, North Dakota. If there's a better deal on Niobrara crude from Colorado or Eagle Ford crude from Texas, they can buy it from different locations instead of being locked into one source. So this optionality has really been a big driver towards people using rail instead of using pipelines to get the crude out. So, of course, you can't put crude oil onto rail cars without having a place to unload the rail cars. So over the last number of years, there's also been a lot of development in terms of crude oil offloading capability. As you can see, it's kind of scattered around the coast, a lot of facilities down along the Gulf Coast, up into Oklahoma, where there's a lot of pipeline connectivity. But if you get crude oil into something like Cushing, Oklahoma, you can put on a pipeline and get it down to the Gulf Coast where the refineries are at. So that's kind of a proxy for the Gulf Coast area. There are also a lot of big facilities that have been built on the East Coast to receive crude oil. And then you can see also on the West Coast there are a smattering of projects that are getting built. Some are further along than others. But it's something that's been scattered around all over the place where people are building the facilities to receive the crude oil to get it into the refineries. This is another comment on the quality of the crude oil. This is, as was pointed out, I think, tends to all be very light, sweet crude oil, which is like the West Texas Intermediate. It's a very sweet crude that a lot of the refineries in the United States were originally designed to build because that was the most plentiful crude oil that was produced for a lot of years. Over the last few years, the last 20 years or so, a lot of refineries, especially on the Gulf Coast, have invested a lot of money to be able to run more of the heavier sour crude like was produced in places like Venezuela and Mexico. But that's really focused primarily on the Gulf Coast. A lot of the refineries in places like the West Coast and East Coast are really designed for more of this light sweet crude, which this shale crude happens to be very much like. So kind of summarizing where we stand right now with this, all of this great crude being produced in the Mid-Continent. Essentially in the Midwest, all of the refineries in the Midwest essentially are running 100% North American crude oil. Some of it's Canadian, a lot of it's Bakken, whatever the local crude is. For years, there were a lot of imported crude that went up to places like Chicago and Pipeline, but those pipelines are basically idle. There's no imported crude oil coming into the Midwest at all. The Midwest is 100% running North American crude today. If you go to the Gulf Coast, it's a similar situation in terms of the light sweet crude oil. There is still, but because of the number of heavy crude oil, high conversion refineries that have been built on the Gulf Coast, there still is a demand to run those plants to have the heavier crude oil from places like Mexico and Venezuela. And the Canadian oil sands crude is another thing that fits very well into those refineries, which is a lot of the driving force for the Keystone XL project, which I won't get into here. But at this point, all of the light sweet crude oil essentially that the Gulf Coast refineries demand is being supplied from domestic crude oil. There are no more light sweet crude oil imports coming into the Gulf Coast anymore. Now, the East Coast is even a more interesting story because the East Coast is a place where over, you know, say 5 or 6 years ago, about half of the refining capacity in the East Coast was either shut down because of poor economics or was threatened or had a shutdown announced. That whole refining complex was really in a state of crisis where the economics didn't work. They're having to compete with imported gasoline coming from places like Europe and the Middle East, and their crude costs were very high because they had to run. They were designed for light sweet crude oil. They had to buy that crude oil from places like West Africa or North Sea Brent blend type of crude oil. So it was very expensive for them to get the crude that they needed. And their economics were challenged because the product prices were tough because of the imported product coming over from places like Europe and the Middle East. So this refining complex was shutting down probably... four or five refineries were actually shut down for a period of months or years until this whole shale boom started up, brought down natural gas prices. Things like Bakken crude oil became available by rail to improve the economics. And now suddenly the East Coast actually has a healthy refining complex. So the East Coast refineries are back up and running. Imports of foreign crude oil are down by about 50%. In fact, they'd like to get more of the North American crude oil, which is limited by their own, by the rail capability and the number of rail facilities they have to be able to pump off this crude oil. So it's been a huge turnaround for the East Coast refining complex, and literally thousands of jobs are back that were at jeopardy or gone when all these refineries are being shut down because of the poor economics. So it really is a complete change of view in the East Coast. So finally, West Coast is kind of the missing piece in this crude by rail situation. You know, the West Coast, actually, if you look at the Bakken in North Dakota, the closest place to get to the coast is the West Coast. It's a lot harder to get to places like the East Coast just because of rail congestion, that type of thing. You could get down to the Gulf Coast, but the Gulf Coast already has got all of the imported sweet crude backed out, so there's really no need to get more of the light sweet crude oil down to the Gulf Coast. So the West Coast is the place that's really the next area that this domestic crude oil has to go in order to be able to continue to support this booming production and the ability of the United States to continue backing out imported crude oil and replacing it with domestic production. So this was Tesoro's answer, which is the Anacortes Rail Facility. We approved this project back in 2011. We saw the balances coming out. We had to struggle a lot saying, do we think the crude by rail is really going to be something that makes sense? And finally decided, yeah, it really did. The economics and the long-term perspectives really showed that that was the right thing to do. So we invested in building this facility. It's been operational for over 2 years now. To this point, we've safely offloaded over 30 million barrels of Bakken crude oil into Anacortes, backing out primarily imported crude oil as well as a lot of the Alaska North Slope crude oil that's been, because it's declining in production, is also becoming more expensive and less attractive for us to process. So this has been a great project. It's been really a great success with us being able to support bring in domestic crude oil in place of the imported crude we used to have to use for Anacortes to balance out. So as I mentioned, one of the questions was, will crude by rail continue? When we built the Anacortes facility, we had some doubts about how long this window of crude by rail would last. But as things have developed, we're more and more certain that crude by rail is something that's going to be a fit for the long term. And really the reason goes back to the map we showed before, that there's this production all sits in the middle of the United States. There's pipeline infrastructure that you could expand to get it to places like the Gulf Coast, but the Gulf Coast is already saturated with their ability to run this light sweet crude oil. So where the Bakken crude oil in particular really needs to go is two places. One is to the East Coast, needs to continue to have access to it. And then secondly, the West Coast is the other untapped area that the crude has to get to in order to be able to fulfill the promise of being able to find a home for all this crude oil and back out imports. Essentially, I don't think there's any way that a pipeline will get built from North Dakota to the West Coast or to the East Coast. Like the challenge, logistical challenges, permitting challenges, and just pure economic hurdles would be a non-starter. To me, it seems extremely unlikely unless there's some kind of legislative push or something that makes something different happen. Crude rail is like by far the most economic, and the key is that we have to be able to, as an industry, working in partnership with the railroads and with the communities and the response contractors and everyone else, we have to make sure that we can do it safely. It all comes down to being able to safely transport the crude oil. It's the same as with pipeline. There are risks that we manage crude by rail. We have different risks, but we have to be just as diligent about managing it because absolutely spills, problems like that aren't something we can accept. We have to do everything we can to control it and do it safely, but this is something that we see is going to be a part of the United States energy future going forward. So with that, I'd like to turn over a little bit and talk about our Vancouver Energy Project. Oops. I jumped too quick. Okay, so back at the Vancouver Energy Terminal Project would be located here across the river at Vancouver. Capacity, the total built-out capacity would be about 360,000 barrels a day. Essentially, that's four unit trains a day that the full capacity would be. To put in context, understand that the current freight train traffic through Vancouver currently is about 70 to 80 trains a day. So we'd be bringing in four when the facility is fully built out. Initially, we're only planning to build it for like one or two trains a day, something like 60 to 180, 120,000 barrels a day of capacity. Fully built out, though, this 360,000 barrels a day would be enough capacity to back out about a third of the imported crude oil to the West Coast. So this crude oil would come into Vancouver and then be loaded on double-hulled U.S. flag tankers to go to the various refining centers, particularly in California, as well as L.A. and Bay Area refineries, to be able to use this crude instead of bringing in the imported crude. This project is a joint venture with the Savage Companies. Savage was our partner on this, mainly because they share our values in terms of safety and environment. They're actually the operators of our rail facility in Anacortes, and they've done a great job. We've been very pleased with their performance, and so it's a great partnership. And when the Port of Vancouver went out and asked for proposals for people to build an oil terminal, we decided to partner with Savage because we felt they brought that operational excellence and that core commitment to safety and environment that we had to be our partner in the project. So moving on a little bit about the port, the one big reason the Port of Vancouver is so exciting is that they've invested something like $175 million to improve the rail infrastructure at the port just so they could attract some kind of major freight terminal. And so they have made this investment, and we're there to kind of fulfill the promise of that investment by providing the customer that will use this facility that they've invested in. The other advantage with the Port of Vancouver is if you start in North Dakota, that's actually the closest place to get to a port where you can load onto vessels, ocean-going vessels, is Vancouver. You know, there are no other direction, whether you go south, east, the closest place to get to the water is Vancouver. And even the rails that go up to places like Anacortes go through Vancouver and then turn to go up there. So this is the Port of Vancouver actually minimizes the amount of miles that crude by rail goes across land before it gets loaded onto vessels. And of course, another advantage for Vancouver is we feel like there's a workforce there. We feel like that the jobs that we offer will be well received there, and this is something to be a boom for the economics of the community as well. And then again, this is with deep water access on the Columbia River. This gives us access to get this crude oil wherever on the West Coast it's needed. You know, anywhere from Alaska to Los Angeles, we'd be able to get access to using the U.S. flag tankers out of Vancouver. then we'd also be using the Columbia River pilots and the bar pilots to be able to get out, because this is a very unique area from a marine standpoint. This, just real briefly on this picture, what I want to do is point out where the terminal physically sits. And it's way at the very far west end of the terminal complex is where the loop is at, and the tank facility will be out very close to that. So it's on the very west end of the port. A little more specifics about the design. There'll be a crude unloading area within the loop unit train track. Then we'll build six storage tanks that'll all be double-bottomed, set up for to be resistant to earthquakes. And then from there, it'll load directly onto marine loading facilities to get it out to the water. There's no processor or anything that happens there. It's really just a build-out. Again, we're very committed to safety. The picture actually shows some testing we did out in the Columbia River of a new type of boom that actually is designed to be able to handle spill containment and recovery in currents up to 4 knots. So we're very active in terms of trying to be aggressive and on the forefront of technology in terms of things like spill response, because it is critical for us to be very strong in that area. There's also a lot of talk on rail safety. I will just make the comment that Tesoro was among the first refiners that made the commitment early this year, and there was when all of the rail car issues began to get loaded up, that we stepped out and made a commitment that we would have nothing but CPC 1232, which is the newer rail car standard that was approved after really everything built after October of 2011 has been to this new standard. We were the first to commit ourselves that we were going to go to get rid of all the old DOT 111 cars, and they were all out of our fleet by June of this year. So we're no longer bringing any old DOT 111 cars into Anacortes. We would not bring any of the 111 cars into Vancouver Energy Terminal either, whether that's our own unit trains or trains we buy from someone else. So we are committed to move forward with, as the rail car standards get adopted, we'll continue to lead in that area. And I talked a little bit about the overall economic picture. The big number is the $2 billion, which was the total economic value to the regional economy. A lot of that obviously is from wages, both for the employees that are there full-time, as well as the labor during the construction period. And then the taxes, $22 million one-time, and then $8 million a year ongoing. So the process is still going through the FSEC process, which we're committed to following. We think it's a very thorough and a good process, and we're hoping to see it through sometime in the next year. So with that, I think I'm about out of time, and just want to summarize that this U.S. energy future has really changed. It's a different world right now with all this domestic crude oil production. It's great to be able to see places like North Dakota supplementing or replacing places like the Middle East as source of our crude oil. And we think that rail infrastructure is something we just have to continue to get good at. And it's particularly critical that we work hard with the rail companies, with everyone else in the value chain, to make sure that we're committed to get every single train worth of crude oil from the fields delivered into the refinery safely. And that's the only way this whole thing can be successful, is if we're successful in protecting the communities and the environments on the way. So with that, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Rick, for bringing your wealth of knowledge and experience to the group. I think it was very very great to hear the perspective and bring that experience here. So let's give Rick another great hand. We are scheduled for lunch now, and it's a buffet style right out here. And I think we come back here, Sarah, to eat. Okay, so grab.
Yeah, we're out in the lobby.
Yeah, wherever you can find a place to sit. The great thing that we have an hour and 15 minutes, and the great thing about that is it's good networking time, which is always a good thing. So take advantage of that. And we're scheduled to start at 1:30, so please be back, and I'll ask the next panel to be ready a minute or two beforehand so that we can get rolling on time. Enjoy lunch. Thank you.